Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, a good friend of mine, Shane Smith, pastry chef extraordinaire. Got a new book coming out, Loaf Tin Bakes. Should be on shelves.
Right, you're doing.
Absolutely brilliant, yeah. Just the £2 loaf tin. What a great show. Because obviously there's so many cookbooks, in particular sweet pastry, bakery books. And everybody's got a £2 loaf tin lying around. Nearly everybody.
Brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic.
And I'm sure now the recipes will be bulletproof. So
yeah, no, he's a great guy. I do an awful lot of food festivals over the years with Shane. I've known him a long time, and looking forward to catching up with him. I haven't seen him. Haven't seen him in a while. We will have our culinary conundrums as always and our Nespresso professional recipe of the week. Don't go anywhere. Joining us now on Dishing It Out is a good pal of mine, Shane Smith. Welcome to Dishing It Out. Pastry chef, baker extraordinaire.
Master baker.
I was going to say, what it is. Fully fledged pastry chef, but obviously it's baking and all the likes of it. I suppose the pastry chef tag really is whenever you're in the professional environment, isn't it?
Yeah, and I suppose people think as well as a pastry chef that you haven't kind of trained either as in like on the savoury side of things. So I suppose back when I started college back in the day when things were in black and white, it was savoury food first. And then after I'd say about 6-8 weeks in college, I realised... Yeah,
is that boys sugar. Like us looking at you coming out of your pastry corner going, get out of the kitchen?
The abuse.
Where did you train?
Killybegs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So Killybegs. It was...
did you go on and do advanced pastry then?
Yeah, went on to GMIT and done a diploma in advanced and specialised pastry.
Very cool.
So kind of done
You're
that.
A Cavan man, right?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
Just outside Virginia.
Yeah. And what year did you go to Killybegs?
2000.
Oh, right. I was going to say, yeah, because it couldn't have been a million miles after my time. Yeah, but 5 or 6
They just built the new kitchens on, so we were the first year, I think, to kind of get in there and wreck the joint a little bit.
Boyle got her hands on you then, I'd say.
Yeah, she's class. A good friend. Yeah.
She's brilliant.
And where was the first, where did you work then after when college? Or were you working while you were in college? Or?
Both. So I started off when I was probably 16 in the Kilmore Hotel in Cavan. So that was the kind of, went to an open day with mum. I think she was like, oh Jesus, no, are you going to go into the kitchens kind of thing? Because I was always tricking away and cooking at home. Right. So I went into an open day and there's this lady sitting on top of the room working for Cert at the time. And she sold it as this lovely, like, which it is, don't get me wrong, I'm still 27 years later, I'm still in it, but
yeah,
she painted this beautiful picture. And then we went into the kitchen afterwards and the head chef at the time, he just cooked a steak with onions and mushrooms and blew my mind. Yeah. I was like, what is this?
Wizardry.
Yeah, he's eating. Because the pan was smoking hot. It wasn't stewing in the pan.
Yeah.
And that was it. I went out straight away to reception.
First steak you ever ate that had a crust.
Mom will not listen to this. Hopefully she killed me. But went out and got a form straight away and started doing weekend work. And I was in doing salads and... Mom said
the larder first.
Straight off the bat, and mom was like, you know, you're going to be washing dishes all day. So I'd myself mentally prepared for that. But they threw me straight over to the salads for the carvery. That was off the bat. So just kind of went in there. And of course, I'll never forget, I was doing a beautiful bowl of tomatoes and I was placing them all nice and neatly and whatever. And one of the girls was like, there's 150 people already queuing up.
Yeah, come on.
Threw the whole lot in here. Like, so I think they knew from get go, this lad now, he's
yeah, I'd be in the Kilmore a good bit actually, because it's only 15, 20 minutes from my, I live very near it there. Yeah. You were there for a long time, were you?
Probably. I'd say 4 years on off, so that's what paid for it through college as well.
Yeah,
to our cert at the time, used to get £50 a week.
Oh, you remember the grant money coming
in? Oh, stop.
The
big queue, the big queue at the ATM machine waiting for midnight. It was like, oh, away you go then. So, so you get £50 and that used to cover the rent and your bus money up and down.
It did,
and a couple of nights out as well. But the Kilmore then was brilliant because that was the kind of extra money. So, we were the lads that would go to the carvery midweek when everyone else was eating.
Yeah. And you knew the chef, so you were all extra sluice.
Yeah, it was.
And then did you move into pastry there? Or?
So after that, then I done my 2 years. I worked in a lovely little place in Annagry in Donegal, Danny Minnie's, and it was kind of more
brilliant.
Fine dining kind of thing. So there was a really good pastry chef there. So I kind of at that stage was like, okay, this is
for me.
This is intricate. Wow, there's a lot of detail
up there.
Yeah, Danny Minnie's.
They have a great reputation.
Unbelievable. Brian was unreal. Yeah. And Terry, God rest her, she was the most glamorous person I ever met. She owned the restaurant, so she would always be the hostess. And it was a different side because I kind of came from hotels and then to kind of go in and see this. it was just hospitality at its finest. But as in, you walked in the door and you were just made to feel like a rock star from the minute you came in to the minute you left. It was unbelievable. So kind of from that on, I realized, you know, pastry is kind of where I want to be. So then I finished up college my 2 years and I went to Knockgranny House in Westport. So that was the first kind of five star.
Seamus there? Or?
No, it was Philip Brazzell was there at the time. Cool. Yeah. So, and that was a baptism of fire. Like in the best and worst possible ways.
Gay club, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. Such a talent.
Yeah.
But it was hardcore. I think it was it was probably the first kitchen I worked in that was very kind of army style. It was regimented. Like you had to do things a certain way. And, you know, first job.
Now, Granny's got a great reputation. I mean, it's always been good. And obviously, Seamus has brought it on to a whole other level as well. Yeah. It's ran right. It always has been. It's the same family that's had it now.
Yeah.
For
Adrian and Geraldine has had it for years.
And how long did you spend there?
Probably, I would say 2.5 years. And I think I was at the point where it's like, okay, you've got to keep moving, kind of moving on.
And was
to
that like, give it as an idea what was going on there? Was that like a lot of plate of desserts? He was making the bread?
So no, it was savoury straight away. So like there wasn't a chance. They didn't.
Straight into the hot kitchen.
So it was kind of, you were a commie chef coming in from Killybeg. So you were straight away like day one on placement, crisp white uniform. And we were put
one
up.
Of the lucky ones though, sent to Westport on a
place.
They wouldn't send me there. They told me I was too mad. I wasn't allowed to go.
I went down to visit a couple of pals actually. And when I was down visiting them, they were like, geez, you should think about doing your final placement here. So that's where I kind of looked into it. But yeah, first day I went in, it was cleaning canopies and it was cleaning cookers and it wasn't, you know, it was very, I wouldn't dress it up as, it was a tough gig. Like it was very, things have changed a lot, I would see in the last couple of, probably 5-10 years or so, but this was an old school kitchen. It was very, as I said, regimented. So it wasn't easy by any means, but it was salad, it was veg prep, all that kind of stuff. It wasn't glamorous, but just where the cold section would be, the pastry section was just over the far end of the kitchen.
So
I was always kind of daydreaming when they were like,
the light at the end of the tunnel.
It's like a mirage in the desert of the water. I was over there, they were that lad daydreaming again. But there was amazing head baker over there and pastry chef. So eventually, after a long time, it was like asking them and please can I move over. Eventually they moved me over for kind of what I used to do after service. You'd finish at maybe 10, 11 at night.
You jump in the pastry.
I go over and help them clean down and do all that. They might remember it differently, here he comes again. the interest was there, and I was like, that's where I want to be. That's where I want to go. So it was a lot of, and it was I won't dress up. It was frowned upon at times for fellas to do pastry. The time, it was always the girls were over in the pastry kitchen, and the bakers. Ray was there at the time; he was brilliant. So the bakers were more fellas, but definitely it was a team of women that was over there. So and there was that.
Is that Ray Hostilier?
Yeah,
my pastry chef when we opened.
He's incredible. A talent.
I still think he's the best baker I've ever worked with.
Yeah. I remember like he just
his breads are mind blowing.
Unbelievable. We used to do everything. Like for the weddings, you'd have all your fresh bread rolls. Everything was handmade. We had our ice cream machines. We were making ice creams and sorbets like from get go. Everything was homemade. Nothing was brought in. So like for that aspect, I learned so much. Like don't get me wrong.
Very lucky then. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a good platform to understand the ins and outs of how a pastry kitchen works. And it was also you had your amenities in the room, but you also had the fine dining aspect, but then you had, you know, afternoon teas, and then you had weddings. We could do up to 150 or so at a wedding. So there was so many things happening at the one time.
That's why there was so much regiment and discipline.
It had to be
part of it.
Like I remember they bought a smoker at the time, and it was unbelievable. Like
that was probably this, really cutting edge.
Unbelievable! And one of the lads decided then he wanted to do cold smoked butter. Sure, nearly fainted. What are you talking about? And he was doing like a cold smoked beurre blanc sauce.
Isn't it gas though? Whenever a chef like comes on something or something new, whenever Daniel was unbelievable for it in Viewmount House, you know he'd.
He's brilliant.
I mean, there was a fridge broke down one time, and like we just see scrap metal, whatever. He saw a smokehouse. Yeah. Like, what are you on about?
Yeah.
Out into this old farm that he'd got off
the drill,
where he's building a house. Next thing, he's built this thing around it, stuck a pipe into it, wedged the door shut, and next thing, like the venison that he's been shooting, like we're smoking haunches and doing whatever. Like, Jesus Christ!
And where was when was the next step after that?
So I moved away and I worked down in, it stayed in Westport, and I worked in a little restaurant called The Linnamill with Eddie and Gayla, and they were a lovely couple, and they worked there for about a year or so. And then they decided to close up that restaurant. They were there for a couple of years.
Right.
And then I reapplied back in Knockgranny for head pastry chef. I went in straight away. So I'd done it. Obviously, I was doing all the desserts in there. So I was probably definitely overstretching the mark. I said, no, you have to. Something that's always been instilled in us growing up with mum and dad. It was like, if you don't ask, you don't get.
Oh, sure.
So
yeah.
I applied first, got the job. So I went back in as head pastry chef then.
Wow, I never knew you were in there for that long.
So I stayed there for another probably 2 years, I'd say, and then I went traveling then after that. But yeah, no, it was nice to step away, see something else, get a bit of clarity, and then kind of go back up.
And you've been out of hotels and restaurants a while, have you?
Yeah.
Like, how many years now have you been just doing
probably
other?
I went to Canada for a year, and when I came back I was the head pastry chef in the G Hotel in Galway for probably 3.5-4 years. So I moved to Dublin in 2011 to go work in a Michelin star restaurant that didn't work out at all. And it's just one of those things, I suppose. You kind of know yourself, you're always kind of reaching for more and more and more. And there's burnout and there's all that goes along with it. So I ended up working days from that. So that was 2011 and I haven't worked nights. I remember a mate of mine, a friend of mine, I got in Westport, she said to me, once you work day shifts, you will never go back. I was like, okay. But I started then as head of product development in Fallon and in Dublin in 2011.
You've had such a varied career.
Yeah, there's lots of
pastry
different
and bakery gives you, I suppose, in a way, because so much of it happens during the night or early in the morning.
But that's like, just it.
All the work is whenever everyone's sleeping.
Yeah, but I think it opens up so many probably other avenues as well, even from the product development. When Paul and Fiona, when I started with Fallon and Byrne there in 2012, I think it was, we created the first kind of takeaway bakery range. So we created, well, I created for them a full range of cakes and loaf cakes and all of that. So that aspect, so we kind of moved into retail.
Yeah.
So you're kind of, the coffee shop was upstairs, you had the restaurant on top of that, you had the wine cellar downstairs, you had weddings for up to 100 people and crock and bushes and all that creative side of thing. But then you also had the retail. And it was like, well, every week you had to sit at a table with a manager's meeting and they were like, so Shane, what happened last week? Why didn't you hit targets? And it was put in front of you. It was the first place I've ever worked in that they were so open and honest to say, well, this is your target for next week and you have to hit X amount. And if you don't, you know, there's a reason. Like, so it was all very transparent, but it was nice to work in an environment like that where I go up on a Friday.
Some people don't like being managed like that, and some people thrive in that, you know.
Yeah.
Not for everybody saying like, the numbers aren't happening there, and you're like,
welcome to our world.
But you do, I think you, if you're invested, which I was, I would have been heavily invested in Fallon and Byrne. It was just an amazing place to work.
What year would that have been?
2012.
Right.
So
because in the last few years, I think the public's appetite, for the want of a better word, to actually buy a gift of a cake and bring it to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, I think Lotteray is probably the most famous example of that, where in France, and I was actually speaking to a French friend about this, we're like, it's really common that if you're going to someone's house, you bring some macaroons or whatever.
Yeah.
And they were like, but now in Ireland, it's really common now. Yeah. To bring a gift of a cake because some people
it's so
drinking,
but it's really personal as well. I think it's
for sure.
If you're going to buy something or even make something, you know what I mean. It's an extra instead of the good old bottle of wine that you bring. I think
which is lovely.
Like
is, I mean,
which is
it's
nice.
Not wrong getting a bottle of wine, but I think it's. I agree with you. It's
nice.
Really because you're showing them a little bit of your personality. That
I
like.
Yeah.
Whatever spices or whatever it is you decide to bring, and I think that's here to stay. I think that explosion of pastry shops and that's not going anywhere, I don't think.
No, and you just look at the scene in Dublin at the moment. It's just booming. There's bakeries now. I get that there's ones closing as well, but there's a huge range of like really, really good, amazing bakeries, world-class bakeries.
And when it comes to pastry, obviously the one thing everybody always says like is recipes are recipes, but I suppose for someone that has a natural flair for it, would you disagree with that? Like, did you always have a gras and a love for pastry, or do you find that all the fundamentals going all the way back to, say, Danny Minnie's or going back to the early days in Knockgranny? Is it all methodical, recipe-based, or have you definitely, over time, got to the stage where I don't need to be weighing every little thing now anymore?
The way my brain works is everything is weighed out, and I have folders and I have recipes, and that's just the way that I work. But I remember standing beside my mum when I was a kid on a stool.
Yeah.
Such thing as a weighing scales. It was a handful of this, and the bread worked out every single time. So that confuses me to this day still. I don't understand how my granny and my mum could just whip it up, or I would be very much. I think when you manage a kitchen brigade, which I've done over the years quite a bit, you know, you need to be able to build a repertoire of recipes that you can stand back and then you know that it's going to work. So I think from years of working
in kitchens, it can be made when you're off.
Yeah.
I remember also making one loaf of bread and making 60 loaves of bread. If you don't use the wine scales,
it's completely different.
Yeah.
Like, I would do a lot of product development for companies as well. That's part of the new role that I'm doing. And a lot lot of people think, well, it's just about, we'll just multiply that recipe by 100.
Yeah,
it doesn't. I wish.
See, that works out for you. Yeah, yeah.
Why has everything exploded in the prover? I'm like, yeah.
It's gassy. You mentioned that there. There's a woman, Anna Buchanan. I used to call her Granny Tiger. Like, it was almost like a third granny I had growing up. I used to stay with my aunt and uncle-in-law all the time growing up. But to this day, she was the first baker or home baker I was ever around. And like, she made this treacle bread and these scones. So I remember then years later, like back 05, and by 20 I came back from Boston. So this is like from the 80s to now 2005. I'm like, Anna, like, tell me the recipe. So she's, look, just come someday and stand beside me. But I still tried. It was literally hand. She had this mug.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter how many I did a little video. I watched her. I wrote down notes. Could not. She could not.
But it's a feeling as well of knowing how the dough is and all that as well.
She could not put it on paper what she was doing or what she was using. It was mental and could never ever replicate the breads. Never.
Yeah.
Never.
I think it's confidence as well. And I think it's, you have to make mistakes. Like, you have to continuously to realize why this didn't work out, why that didn't work out. So you have your recipes all lined up, but it's also a confidence thing. Over years, I would become, like anyone in a job of yours, you become more confident. So you're able to do it a lot faster, and you know by looking at it beforehand if it's a bit warmer in the kitchen, the butter's softer, so you know that you're not going to mix it as much, or if you're taking your eggs directly from the fridge, if you keep them in there, that's going to change the recipe. So it's knowing all of those little nuances that's going to change a recipe on your, if you bake something and it doesn't work out, it's kind of taking a step back and saying, well, this is why.
It's funny when you're teaching somebody how to cook or to bake and you tell them that and they're looking at you agreeing with you, and then
it only comes with experience, you can't force that process. And that's practice. I remember taking holidays once. I went away for a week. It was when I was, after Fallonburn, I moved out to Airfield Estate in Dundrum, so I was there for 6.5-7 years. So I kind of ran product development
it was 94.
I mean, yeah. Had a lot of work done. Have we been recorded? Have we? You couldn't tell. It's good lighting in here, I'll give you that much. But six, seven years out there. But that was during COVID as well, so everyone was kind of hanging on as well during
that.
A lot
of banana bread recipes kicking around there.
Oh, Lord, I swear to God. But I went away for a week's holidays and I come back and they were giving out stink. The scones didn't work. And what's wrong with your recipe? I said, it's the same recipe that we've been using since day one.
Yeah.
But one day, the lads in the kitchen had dumped the bicarbonate soda into the baking powder tub instead. So there were just big green blobs in the oven every day, and they were cursing me. There I was having the best time ever on my holidays. I know the place was erupting in Dundrum, but little things like that. And again, it's, you should know by looking at it. But again, if you don't have that experience, you know, it's those little things that'll trip you up.
What are you doing these days then? We'll get to your new book very shortly, but obviously media stuff and whatever. But are you in a day-to-day kitchen stuff?
No, 2022, I finished up in Airfield, and then I went out on my own at that point, because I think working in restaurants and kitchens for so long, it's always the dream, and everyone always says to you, you're going to open up your own place.
Yeah,
so hard. And I've seen it firsthand working for other people and other places, how difficult. So that never really has been
my dream
to open up my own place. I just see that the stress and hours and everything you put into it, and I was like, there's other ways. It always, something sticks in my head. Mom used to say, do you want to be lugging pots around a kitchen when you're in your 50s? Yeah. And I was like, well, maybe, I don't know, but it was always there. I was like, maybe there's an easier, because my mom and dad would work very hard, you know. So I was kind of thinking, right, maybe there's a different route I can take. So I suppose between the product development and all that as well, in 2022 I opened up my own online cookery school.
Yeah.
So I invested heavily in that, and that ran well for a couple of years. So there was still that kind of need for a lot of people that wanted to learn as well how to bake. So I was running that on the side, and then my consultancy business. So I was doing a lot of consultancy work, going in with small producers and helping them upscale to get into supermarkets and that. So I was working with Simply Better and Dunn Stores for a while with that, which was really good and eye-opening.
It's
as
brilliant.
Well,
like, you've got so many different avenues the talent, like, to be able to, you know, as you say, like the retail end of it, that's, and huge. The commercial end.
I think years ago when you went to college, it was like you can just work in a restaurant or you can work in a hotel, that's it, where there's so many other different avenues now. But then I went back to college in 2024, so I went back to Maynooth University and done a HDIP in further adult education.
So I'm now
teaching. So that's the,
where are you doing that?
In Dunboyne College of Further Education.
So
that's the, and it's part-time, it's not full time, but I'm in there doing probably they're flexible with the schedule, which is good, because when you have so many moving parts kind of going on, it's nice to say, well, I'll take April off, but I'll kickstart again in May. So I do a lot of international cuisine, pastry, bacon, desserts, culinary techniques, and then I was covering full time for one of the lectures. September gone, so it was my magic. Full.
Are you following your own curriculum, or are you following there?
You'd have to. It's a QQI level 5 qualification, so you have to follow it. And like, it's like, you know, there's now, is it a Duchess or a Josh Esmontation. <Yeah. laughs> Your gorgeous little piped pyramid of spuds, which, you know, like
Concast.
There is a little bit of that in it. Even
it's
the
mad that they're still showing people how to do
weird
stuff.
You know those old recipes from college, when you do make them, they're amazing. Like,
they give you such a foundation.
And that's why people are still learning them, you know.
Even the pastry course there, the last day we had, I had a group in and I was teaching them how to make souffles. And like the stress, even me, like I'm always very...
Yeah, you better raise.
Calm, I'm calm and collected in the kitchen. And then all of a sudden, you go to make a souffle and the voice gets higher and you're starting to sweat. And
there's not a chef in the world that doesn't feel that.
Oh fucking souffle, man. It'll leave you trembling, you know.
That teaching aspect, I think it's been an easy transition from, I suppose, teaching... You're teaching anyways as a chef every single day when you're in your own pastry kitchen or in the main kitchen. You're teaching and you're sharing that skill set with people that want to learn. Some of the best chefs I've ever worked with have come in to work in the pastry section, haven't been to college, but they've had that natural grow and hunger, and they're inquisitive and they want to learn, and they're some of the best people that I've ever worked with along as well. So that aspect is good, but I think it's about sharing knowledge. The teaching, it was easy to kind of go into that, and it's easy to kind of go in and show how to make stocks, and it's savoury and sweet.
Did you venture much into the world of vegan diets with pastry? You know, like I've noticed in my own job that we have to have a vegan starter, a vegan main course and a vegan dessert on all of our menus.
Yeah.
And our pastry chef have started really using like vegan creams and substitutes. And some of them, the quality has really gotten better in that area. Is that something that you've looked at a lot?
It was on the way when I was, I suppose, in Airfield. Wouldn't have been that buzz because it was farm. It was our Jersey herd. You know, we were using the Jersey milk every day for our scones and everything. So we weren't accommodating. We were, but it wasn't a priority for us. So in a way, I've kind of bypassed that a little bit. I'm always testing recipes at home. I share a lot online, and I would have tried vegan recipes. I would have found vegan recipes initially back in the day very sweet, like high in sugar. Yeah. And a lot of people relied on the sugar to keep it.
There's nothing purer than the fat cycles. Like if we think back 10 years ago, it was gluten was the enemy of everybody, right? Yeah, and everyone, and you're going, 0.1% of the population is celiac, or it's like a really tiny percentage. Yeah, there's 4 people in the restaurant asking me for gluten-free bread. I'm like, that's gone now. Yeah. That's stopped.
I'd definitely dabble an awful lot into gluten-free baking. That's definitely very big.
Speaking of Rolling Boyle, she had one of the best gluten-free loaf recipes going. I think was the one that Nevin made a use too. You know, I don't
was
know
it like a brown bread? Or was
I don't know, did Nevin steal it from her or vice versa or whatever, but yeah, they often chat about
you know when the global platform is taking that any type of diet seriously when some of the big like Valrhona are bringing vegan chocolate. So you've released a book.
Yes.
So that's an exciting
loaf tin bakes.
Yes.
I love it. Cause, you know,
I'm a country boy. Keep a country.
Just before we came on air, we were just saying and obviously we know ourselves just from publishers, trying to find a niche in a very populated category. Absolutely brilliant one to hone in on. Everybody's got a loaf tin.
That's it.
And it's based on two-pound loaf tin.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose really I'd went in and I had meetings with Gil throughout the years and they weren't ready or I wasn't ready. And now in hindsight, when I look back on it, I probably wasn't. So it was the right time for me to
listen, Gil are telling me and Gareth we're not ready either. We've got news for you, Gil Books.
Maybe
get off the fence. Get off the fence.
You're looking for a new vegan cookery book there, guys.
Back in the bollocks.
But the meeting with them went well and they literally said come in and have a chat. They contacted me and they made it clear from get go as in like you're not getting a book, as in like let's have a conversation and see if there's something out there. So it was very much my job to kind of sit back. Now I had the idea in the back of my mind for a while, but done a bit more research into it and went in with a pitch and it landed and they were very happy with it. But no, they're amazing to work with, I have to say. Like, and I really underestimated the amount of work that's involved. Like I'm a one man show here, so I do everything myself, like as in my socials, all the marketing and advertising, that's all me that does all of that. So to kind of say I can do this, I remember on day one and I was testing recipes. Even though I'd have certain recipes on file, you still want to test them with something different when you're putting it into print. And I'd never expect anyone to go out and buy ingredients and make a recipe if it hasn't been tested. You know the same yourselves. So it started. So it was last summer. during the kind of heat wave, and there was butter melting everywhere.
Oh, no.
Just questioning every life choice I've ever made.
Should have been a plumber.
Should have just done like a salad book or something.
Yeah.
But no, tested probably, yeah, good, probably 180 or so recipes, and narrowed it down. You could do 2 books with loaf tins. Like, I didn't realise until the scope of it all. So,
and any savoury in there?
Yeah,
it?
So yeah, it's a, cool. It's a 80, there's 81 recipes in it.
Wow.
So the first chapter is your classics. So, you know, your lemon drizzles, coffees, carrot cakes, yeah. Sticky gingerbread loaf, Madeiras, that kind of thing. And then the second chapter is breads. So brioches, focaccias, no need focaccias, porridge breads, jalapeno beer breads. So kind of delving into that side of it as well. But your porridge and your treacle and your brown, the one that people want as well.
Yeah.
And there's a free from chapter, so that's vegan and gluten-free baking as well. Really nice gluten-free bread recipes in that one. Celebration cakes, we kind of tapped into like Paddy's and Easter and Valentine's and done a celebration cake for each
all
one
done
of those.
In Lofton.
All done. So like Christmas cakes, like instead of these big 60 kg kind of ones you've been soaking for 3 years, like a nice kind of smaller one, too low fun as well. And then chocolate chapter, there's one on fruit as well. So yeah, it's ice creams.
I'd say it'll be an absolute banger, mate.
Oh yeah, like ice creams as in making the...
Yeah, so there's two sorbet recipes and it's just made in the tin, but then there's a lot, there's a peanut butter baked Alaska one, it's made in the tin, you flip it. Viennetta brunch ice creams, that kind of stuff as well. So it's fun, it's colourful. Visually, I worked with the most amazing team. I do my own food photography and styling myself, but to work with a team, I would not call myself a professional after that. Probably thought I was a little bit until I rocked in that day, and I worked with Charlotte O'Connell and
six or seven people there, and you're like,
it's a machine. And like, I'm not used to sitting down. I think, again, working in kitchens, like, you know too well, you're just not used to switching off, and like, and you see people taking over and they're making your recipe.
Yeah.
And it's nice because then, you know,
also
it's been tested.
For the shoot, you didn't make the stuff.
I made some, but some they, we had
well,
a
well, then that's one way of catching you out of
100%. And I'm like, that's the fly on the wall podcast you want to be in, listening to stories about food stylists and that, working with people and recipes not being tested. And like, it's just like, I didn't realize that. I thought that everyone would be very much.
Well, I had a very interesting chat many years ago with very, very prominent UK chefs or whatever. And I was over, I was in the studio, I was doing Saturday Kitchen, and I was like, geez, like such and such is banging out a book, or whatever. And he goes, yeah, it's the three ingredients. Thing, chef. I goes, what are you talking about? He goes, once you tweak three things in any recipe, it's now yours.
I think it's a what are you on about? Scent on it, isn't
there? Well, he says, that's what the lawyers say. He
goes,
such and such do a book, and I'm talking now world famous chefs here. And that's what the conversation was about, the books. He just says, like, that's literally, that's what the guys are looking at over here. If you're the big enough name and you get the book deal and you're 10 or 20 recipes short, pull in a few heavyweights, whatever. What would you tweak? Tweak three things there.
Stop.
It's now yours. And that was what they were saying. I was like, I wouldn't want that book.
No.
You know.
But there's an awful lot of people that does that as well. You see that even online when you're sharing recipes and there's very similar ones popping up left, right. It's part of it.
Well, come here. Like, is there a recipe out there that hasn't been done? Yeah. Or like, you know.
It's hard to come up with something original. Although brunches in a love tin, I'm all over.
You're definitely first there.
Painting that one there now, I have.
I mean, like, I'll be the judge of that. I was like, what a fucking brunch in a love tin. I'm all over it.
But I suppose this demographic as well. The people over the years, the following that I've kind of built up over the years with sharing recipes, that's my demographic. And even for myself to step away from the fine dining took a while for me to kind of, because you're so used to hitting at such a high level, there's almost a guilt associated with stepping back and just making simple kind of bakes and be like, well, no, actually, this is what I, no matter what it is, you still enjoy it. But it's a different kind of path that I've taken now. But
the best piece of advice you'd give somebody that's new to the world of baking at home? So, you know, Gary just there a second ago spoke about his daughter, and my daughter bakes as well. So what do you think is the best piece of advice that someone's entering into that world? Maybe they have kids, or if there's a house that cook a lot, but they're
buy a 2 pound
they have
loaf
to
tin.
Have fear.
Click the link below or wherever that is. What I say to you, and what I always say to everyone, is your equipment and your ingredients are going to make or break you. So like, I would invest in a good weighing scale straight off the bat, especially when it comes to pastry. There's that little bit of freedom when it's associated with more the savoury aspect. Sure. But like, if that's what I love about pastry, the recipe will work every time if you follow the recipe correctly. So invest in a good weighing scales. Oven thermometer, really good to know if your oven's running a little bit hotter or colder than what a recipe states. And then don't be afraid to make mistakes. You know, no one ever just woke up, and maybe the bread that you're telling us about, Gary, beforehand that you made first time round and it was emotionally beautiful. But I don't know if you're going to crack it first time round. So if you make mistakes, that's okay. So don't let that deflate you. But again, the quality of ingredients that you use, if you're going to cut corners and buy really cheap chocolate or...
My problem is when the mistakes are amazing and I don't know how.
Yeah. That's when you just...
That's my problem. It was just
like a once-off.
It never looks like that.
You bought that down in Super Value.
Yeah, for sure. Deadly. Well, look, we always like to wrap it up with a death row dinner. I don't know if you can do a full menu of cakes and banks, Shane, but I'm sure you...
You can do whatever you want. It's the last thing you want to eat.
But yeah, what are you having?
Right. I think the trifecta, and this was funny, I was teaching a class a while ago and we were talking about Italian cuisine because I love Italian food, and I was saying to her, well, what would be your favourite Italian dish? And she said to me, well, the holy trifecta, like lasagna, chips and coleslaw. And I wow. And that does kind of stir something up in me. I don't know what that is. I just did it to me too. I travel quite a bit, and I was just back from India and Sri Lanka there a while ago. So butter chicken and warm naan bread is just ultimate comfort food for me. Again, homemade, really nice. That would be comfort. I also love, guilty pleasure is crispy duck pancakes. So nice kind of hoisin. That would be
hoisin sauce.
Yeah, I'm going all out.
I
still remember the first time I tasted hoisin was in a restaurant in Miami, South Beach, Miami, back in 2004. And I had this like hoisin chicken noodles. I was like,
mind blowing.
What is this? It blew me mind.
It was a steak and onions for this man.
Simple beginnings. And then sweet, I've noticed over the years, I've kind of getting a bit nursing homey. I'm gone a bit like custards and all that kind of stuff. I used to be chocolate all the time. Yeah, like a bit of like baked rice with chewed rhubarb or something, or a creme brulee for me. That's if you do a really good velvety brulee, I think is just classic. Nothing else needed. But yeah, nice and soft.
I know. Myself and Garrod and Tara from the old post, back years ago, we were at college, we'd any new opening or restaurants all around Ireland, but we would go here and there. We'd all take turns who was treating who. But we had anybody that had a duck confit, I had it. Anybody worth knowing. And Johnny Cook in Dublin had the greatest duck confit of all time. The best bread was a little restaurant in Galway that was very short-lived. Somebody from the Roost, it was a place called The Archway. There was a French guy that had opened it briefly. Just made breads as well. And another one was creme brulee. If it was on a menu, we had it and we tried it and we judged every restaurant. And you'd be amazed how many of them back in the 90s had the likes of that on, you know. But yeah, creme brulee is it.
We used to do a bain-marie for years, and then I worked with a chef and he was like, no, you can do it dry. So drop in your oven temperature, I think it was 70 something degrees, and there was no water bath neither. That blew my mind.
Yeah.
Has this actually happened to me twice in the same day?
Yeah, no, I don't use my bread for bread.
Well, even from health and safety point of view, with all the water and all that as well.
Just bake them in a low oven.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, 70 for me is a little bit low. You can get up to a little bit higher than that. Okay. Your pastry chef is baking his brulees, I'm telling you now.
I bet he is.
Yes, he is.
But I'm still standing like that.
No. With a hot kettle.
Yeah.
Stuff in. No.
Yeah.
No. My move on, girl.
Oh my God.
Talking about brulees there, just one, I think Paul Flynn's crab brulee would be on the menu as well. I think that'd be the final one. The cucumber as well.
Yeah,
so that'd be on.
There's a whole banquet here. It wasn't just
not a vegan dish between us.
Well, look, thanks a million for coming in.
Pleasure.
Guest, and I'm excited to see your book. Definitely
we'll get a copy.
Help me in.
Yes, be out soon enough.
Thanks a million.
Time for an Nespresso Professional break. Brought to you by Nespresso Professional. Effortless moments, exceptional coffee.
Time now for an Nespresso Professional break. As we serve up this week's dish of the week, we're all about high standards and food on this show. The coffee that goes with it shouldn't be any different. Nespresso Professional delivers barista-style coffee across every kind of venue, from luxury hotels, busy restaurants, to high energy offices and leisure clubs. It means your team and your guests get exceptional coffee to match the experience. We're glad to have them on board. So Gary, what have we got this week?
Yeah, so you and I got chatting a week or two ago. I don't know how it came up or what came up.
I'm doing the Mexican themed food on the rooftop.
You're doing Mexican theme. So I just thought about chicken quesadilla. It's a wee dish I used to do in Boston. I've thrown it on in the Palmer as well a couple of years ago. I might bring it back actually this year. And it's a chicken quesadilla, all right? And I also do it with grilled veggies. So you can do a grilled veggie option or you can mix it up. But the grilled veggies, you're just talking fire roasting some bell peppers, red, green, yellow peppers. Get an aubergine, top and tail it, courgettes, top and tailed, and then slice them on a mandolin, so long strips. Mix all your veg up with a little bit of crushed garlic, salt, white pepper, a little bit of lime juice, lemon juice, and then onto sheet pans, 200 degree oven for about 7 or 8 minutes just to sort of char it and cook it. Take it out, let it cool down and set it aside, all right? The chicken then, you just basically got some cooked chicken breast. So just like add in a little bit of like Mexican spices, like paprika, smoked paprika, salt, pepper, what have you. A tiny little bit of cumin put on there.
Onion powder works.
Onion powder, celery, salt, yeah, and onion powder.
Whatever.
So just basically baste your chicken.
Fajita mix nearly, is it?
Almost, yeah, same idea, because nearly everybody has a wee jar of that sort of stuff. Even a little jar of Cajun mix if it's sitting in.
Yeah, yeah.
Sprinkle it all on. Get it all over the chicken breast and bake them. Cook it, cooled, set aside. And then what you want to do is you're just going to dice up the chicken and you're going to chop up the veg, but into decent sized chunks, into a bowl and add in. Now, it all depends how many you're making. Where obviously, whenever I'm doing them around the restaurant, the guys will make a few. When I'm making them at home, probably like maybe a 400 grams of mozzarella, two chicken breasts, they'll probably do four large quesadillas. So take about 400 grams of grated mozzarella, add in your two breasts of chicken that are diced up, a full handful of fresh coriander chopped up and into the mixture, and then your vegetables, and just fold it with a spoon until it's all well mixed up. And then you're going to get like a 12 inch flour tortilla, all right? Lay it out flat, and on one half of it, the half moon basically, you're just going to put a good handful of your mix on top, and then you're going to flip over, so you're just going to flip the side that's got nothing on it over the top, and then you're going to brush that with olive oil or vegetable oil, whatever you want. Gently turn it over, little bits of cheese, and that's going to be falling out. Don't worry about that. Brush it then with oil again, so you've got the two sides oiled. It's going to feel a wee bit messy, and that's completely fine. Get a non-stick heavy-based frying pan on. Get it medium heat, a decent medium heat, not too hot. You don't want it to be scorching hot. And then using two egg slices or just one egg slice in your hand, lift it on and sit it on. So everything inside's already cooked and it's cooled. It's at room temperature. And you're going to start just cooking it, your pan frying it, for use of a better word, on a really steady medium heat. Once you get the flour tortilla, take a wee peek after about 3-4 minutes. You've got a nice browning on the tortilla. Put your hand on top, fish slice underneath, and then just flip it. Again, first time doing it, little bits are going to pop out. Don't worry about it. Leave it on. Cook it like that until both sides are nice and cool. The cheese will start to melt or whatever. And if you've got a nice little fine level in the inside of it, it's going to melt enough. Like, so you don't want to overfill them, all right? And then set it aside, chop it up into 4 or 5 little triangles, and that's lovely with a big dollop of sour cream, guacamole, and a pico de gallo. A pico de gallo is just a fresh tomato salsa. You'll get a recipe here, there, or anywhere for it. But absolutely beautiful chicken quesadilla.
Delish. Thanks again to Nespresso for sponsoring this part of the show. To find the right coffee solution for your workspace, head to nespressoforbusiness.co.uk. Now we jump into that wonderful part of the show where we get a few questions from you, the listener. So what have we got this week, Aoife?
We have one from Darren that says, "How's it going, G&G? Love that. I'm decent enough in the kitchen and would consider my cooking slightly above average, but I really struggle with the presentation. Everything tastes great, but it looks very underwhelming when it's plated up. Any tips for how I can improve this?"
It's probably the one thing when you start getting confident at cookery that puts the most doubt in your mind. I remember when I started off chefing and I was in college and they'd tell us that we're doing whatever, beef stroganoff, mushroom vol-au-vent, whatever it is. And it would have been the most basic of things and I would have been more worried about the presentation than I would have been about actually cooking the dish correctly. And I think for home cooks, there's probably that same worry or... And the gas part about it is the more confident you get cooking and your presentation gets more confident, that you'll just pull back, and simplicity is generally what food looks at its best. Mm-hmm. So I would say, like, using things like Instagram and TikTok and all these places to watch food plating styles, if that's what you're trying to go after. You never had that years ago. Like, you couldn't go and actually watch somebody that's a professional. Like, it's like saying, I'm going to paint this room. I can now and go and watch some, like, a professional painter, like, masking up everywhere. And it's the same with plating. So it depends what type of cookery you're trying to get better at. But it's really about watching and learning, taking your time, working clean, making sure you have the right type of plates, the right type of equipment.
I was just going to say, that's probably a big thing, is having a nice pasta bowl for your pasta or that.
It's kind of part of it, but like,
funny, one big thing, and I'll jump in here, like, is you've nailed the most important part first and foremost. You feel confident in the kitchen, you're making nice things. That, I mean, that over...
That trumps anything.
You chat about chefs now at our level, professionals or whatever, it took us all to a certain age or whatever to get to the point where you're like going, you just become genuinely confident and happy with things being right. When you stop worrying about presentations, whenever you're really at the mecca stage. Another thing to understand is not every dish you make it's possible to make it look good. Mm. Like, if you look at casseroles or stews or a butter chicken that we talked about with Shane earlier, like, these dishes, just, they look the way they look. Stroganoff, for example, the key thing there is something like that is maybe buy something authentic, like where you might see like an old style Russian plate or whatever, and you're like, instead of it looking molded and you're doing a timbale of rice or whatever and you think that that's cool, it isn't. If you change the plate that it goes into, bring the elegance from the actual vessel and just worry about getting the dish right. So presentation comes in a lot of different forms, and it's literally what it's served in as well as what it looks like, you know what I mean? But it's not something I'd be too harsh on myself over. If you want to fancy it up and it comes to dinner, or maybe you're doing a special occasion and that's where the presentation then takes on a wee bit more meaning, look into the actual dish that you're cooking. Is it something like a chicken curry is hard to make look good, but if you're pan roasting a breast of chicken and you're able to slice it up into little pieces, you brown the skin, you can do loads of other, you can scrape off the bone, get it bone white, make it look like all these tiny little tricks. So you can make a breast of chicken look incredible. Very difficult with a chicken curry, so it's all about the dish too.
You can probably use your garnishing though a little bit, you know, on a curry, even a few fresh herbs. Yeah, exactly. Or like,
look, you can stick a papadom on it, you can have like some scallions like that are thin sliced, they sat in iced water that will flour them out and pop them out. You can curl up a few chilies or bell peppers into ice water, again they'll spiral up. Mix all that in with a little bit of coriander that can create almost like this little hand-picked herb salad that'll sit in the middle of a papadom. You can do a little side serving of a chutney. You can make your own little mango chutney or an apple brunoise chutney, which are accompaniments and a yogurt to a curry, and go into all levels. For sure you can. There's always levels, but I'm trying to make the guy feel good.
The other thing is like, what, you know, it's kind of tricky to give an advice about one particular thing if you don't know what's gone wrong. But I would say small little things like heating your plates, not overloading your plate, you know, having a little cloth beside you to give the plates a wipe. If they're the little mistakes that you might be making, they're all little things that will just come second nature to somebody that works in the business. Yeah. You know, if you're serving family style in the centre of the table, again, not overloading everything, putting a certain amount of it on, leave it on the table, and then I'll top it up a little bit. All those little things. But
that one key trick he said there is less. The less you have on a plate, exactly. the more you can see of the actual base of the plate where the food really pops up.
Yeah, not like loading them all on top of each other. And
it's like one little trick, like a real simple little trick, like that goes like petite, like stuff that then it's small is much easier to look elegant when it's not just a big feed of stuff.
But if you're getting the flavour right, make sure that's
what matters.
Should be. That's
that is what matters.
Yeah, there's no point in it looking lovely and tasting awful.
Yeah, we've all seen it. Thanks as always for sending in your culinary conundrums. You really do enjoy getting them. And if you have any more, send them in to food@goaloutnow.com. So thanks as always for tuning in. We're back next week with our culinary conundrums, our dishes of the week, and another great guest. If you can leave us a review or share it with a friend, that really helps us grow the podcast and has huge benefits for us, even getting new guests. Chat to you next week.
Chat to you then.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.